Hello, everybody. This is Shane Douglas Keene, and you are listening to the Shotgun Logic Podcast. This is episode number one. Thank you for checking us out, and we hope you'll all become regular listeners. Shotgun Logic would not be possible without the efforts of Beverly Lee, Stephanie Ellis, T.C. Parker, our artist who did the line work for us, Nicholas Day, and our band, Bitscar Sudi, who wrote the amazing cosmic horror song that is our theme right now. If you want to go to our website, shotgunlogic.com, and check those guys out, follow the links, throw your support at them. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy this episode.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
We're all pretending. Hey, how are you guys? I always feel goofy doing that after we've introed something.
Yeah.
Because generally we've been sitting there talking to whoever it is for 10 or 15 minutes or something like that.
Have you ever forgotten to press the record button?
Oh, Lord, I've come close. my worst one ever, we recorded an entire one, and I accidentally deleted the video afterwards instead of downloading it.
Oh.
So I was like, you guys want to do another 2 hours tomorrow?
Yeah.
But Rich is really good about taking the blame for stuff like that, so. my ADHD notes, sorry. So really, yeah, let's just take this thing kind of casual and talk about your books and just see where the conversation takes us. I have some kickers, but I don't pay much attention to my notes because I can't read my writing.
Well, at least it's better now we have the visual clues so that we're not going to be, like you say, talking over each other, or there's those sort of silences while I wait for Kath to speak and she waits for me to speak.
Yeah. Exactly. I like this a lot better because I do interrupt really badly, even when I can see what's going on. Let's do this.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I just said, what has Bev got? A glass of water?
I've got the remains of a gin and tonic from tea time. I'm making it last. I was going to finish it and have another one, and I thought, no, that's not a good idea.
I was going to have a glass of bourbon, and I don't have any, so I'm sitting here with tea. And a mic in my face. The stupid sound on my system wasn't working today. That's why I was so disorganized coming into this. But go ahead and let's go ahead. We'll do this, like, if I ask a question, we'll go alphabetical, Catherine and then Bev, if I want both of you to answer, or if just one, I'll say your name.
Okay.
So then in that case, Catherine, you've got some exciting stuff. You've got, from what I understand from Bev, you've got a killer collection out. Mists and Megaliths, is that it?
Yeah. Mists and Megaliths, yeah.
Okay, and then you have the one that I'm reading, Immortelle, is that correct?
That's right, yeah, that's coming out on July 15th.
Okay, so go ahead and tell us, for anybody who doesn't know anything about you or knows little, give us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I'm Catherine McCarthy, I'm a writer from Wales, UK. I was a teacher for 28 years and sort of dabbled in writing without having very much time to, you know, pay an awful lot of attention to it. But since I finished work, I've really sort of started writing much, much more, and published quite a few things. Mists and Megaliths is a collection of 10 stories, all set in Wales, all dark fiction. Different types of horror, including cosmic horror, folk horror, but pretty much they all sort of lean towards quiet horror. Immortelle is a historical gothic novella, also set in Wales on the coast not far from where I live. And that's going to be published by Off Limits Press on July 15th.
And Off Limits Press doesn't make mistakes. If your name is in their list, It's because you're the real deal.
Oh, thank you, Shane.
Sam is a very, very astute publisher, and she's got some of the best editors in the business working for her.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm reading Heart Strange and Dreadful at the moment by Tim McGregor from Off Limits Press, and that is just incredible. You've read it, haven't you, Kath?
I have, yes. It was wonderful. I really loved it. And he's such a fabulous person as well. He's so supportive.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a twist. When it started, I didn't know where it was going to go. Yeah. But I'm kind of, I'm 80% there now, and it's like, oh, this is really good.
And now I feel desperate to tell you something about the ending, but I absolutely...
No, you can't do that, no.
I suspect I know what you're talking about, Catherine.
Yeah.
I absolutely adored that book, and I absolutely adored Tim as well. I realize I'm nervous, and that would be why I said I was going to do this alphabetical and then ask Catherine first. You know, because C and M both come before B and L, right?
in some alphabets, maybe, Shane, so it's fine.
So, yeah, I don't know why I always get nervous when Beverly's around for some reason. I think I get paranoid when I talk to people with accents. I mean, obviously, I have the most cracker accent in the world, obviously, compared to you, which is to say
you
no
have a,
accent.
You have a lovely accent, Faye.
I think for us, though, Bev, because we're so used to hearing the American accent through TV and film, it's sort of second nature. I think it's more difficult for Shane.
Yes, possibly.
Were you so regional?
It's kind of not too difficult for me compared to a lot of Americans, just because I was raised by Irish people and there were a lot of accents around me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Beverly, same question.
Okay. My name is Beverly Lee. I'm from the UK too. I write multi-point of view, character-driven dark fiction, concentrating on the build-up of atmosphere and dread. Currently, I have a vampire suspense series, which is The Making of Gabriel Davenport, A Shining in the Shadows, and The Purity of Crimson. I have a standalone gothic grief horror, The Ruin of Delicate Things. And in September, I'll be releasing my first quiet folk horror, The House of Little Bones.
And I can actually vouch for every single one of those books that Beverly just mentioned.
I've read 2 out of 3, and I'm really looking forward to your next one, Bev.
Thank you, Kath. Immortelle is actually next on my list after I finish Tim, so...
You've got an arc, have you?
Yes, from somebody that's quite close to you.
Yeah, I'm sitting across the virtual table. I cheated and asked if you were... So, obviously, there are some things that are going to come up with this particular grouping, and it's why I have been excited about this conversation. Probably my first love in horror was quiet horror. And basically, when I started reading horror back in the 70s, that was the fair. You know, quiet horror, and then they were starting to get a little bit bolder with stuff like King's stuff. Things like that, but quiet horror was really what dug me in, you know, people, you know, and I'm drawing blanks on all the names I had in my head, but like Straub and, you know, people like that who write these very, very intense people-driven stories. And you guys are both quiet horror writers.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just recently with The Ruin of Delicate Things was reintroduced to it as kind of, you know, because I kind of take what people give me when I was doing book reviews all the time and stuff, so I didn't have a lot of control over it. And then I read Ruin of Delicate Things, and then I read everything that Bev wrote because I remembered how much I loved that kind of horror.
Yeah.
And doing the same thing with you, but what draws you to that, Bev?
I think quiet horror is the kind of horror that people relate to because they can actually imagine it happening to them. It's okay having kind of slasher novels and zombie pictures and things like that, but a quiet horror is the kind of horror that maybe you're sat downstairs and you hear something creaking upstairs and you go and there's nothing there, and then you come back downstairs again and you hear the creak, and it's your imagination that whirls into gear then, and it's the fear of your imagination of what could be, I think, in quiet horror that is what attracts me to it.
Yes, that's interesting too, because it's kind of like the number one cause of an anxiety attack is anxiety over having an anxiety attack. Quiet horror kind of takes that same kind of approach, that you're more afraid of being afraid than you are of what's actually.
Yes, it's almost like if you saw what was making the noise, you wouldn't be half scared.
I like my friend Kelly's approach the other night. She heard something in the other room, and her dog barked. But the dog's still staying here with me, so I'm staying here too. Real life quiet horror there. Catherine?
Well, yeah, I totally agree with everything Bev said. You know, 100%. And for me, it's just, it just comes naturally. I just would never lean towards, you know, more gore. It's just not what I read, and it isn't what I write. It just sort of comes from within, doesn't it, Bev? You know?
Yes, it's
not a conscious decision. And like you say, I prefer the psychological sort of creeping dread then. I prefer to imply something rather than put it straight in someone's face and let imagination do the rest.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's, and that's, I think if you do it well, you both do, it's more effective than someone, you know, basically verbally blowing someone's brains out right there on the screen. Just that. Lost my train of thought there, sorry. What was the last statement you made, Catherine? Do you remember?
I was just saying the sort of creeping dread, the psychological horror, rather than, you know, overt gore, basically.
I still don't know what I was going to say, but thank you for repeating yourself. It'll come back. But yeah, it's just really, for me, it was surprising to me when I started writing fiction, because I've always been a poet, that the very first thing I wrote was extremely quiet. I didn't see that coming out of me at all, because I've been exposed to, you know, my first taste of blood, so to speak, was Clive Barker, and I've been exposed to less extreme and way more extreme over the last probably 7 years, because, you know, there are so many splatter pumps out there, and I don't dislike that. I like that stuff, but I have to really be in the mood for it.
I think with horror, it's a genre that there's room for everybody. I mean, there's so many variations of horror.
Yeah.
That when people turn around and go, oh, I don't read horror, and you think, well, what have you read? There might be another form of horror that you might really enjoy.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say earlier about that. You know, doing things off screen is Joyce Carol Oates, or not Joyce Carol Oates, Flannery O'Connor was a master of that. Like in A Good Man Is Hard to Find and stuff like that. It's a brutal, brutal, violent story, but all the violence happens off the screen, literally. Mm. While the rest of the families in one place, they're being taken out one by one. So, and it's terrifying. And that's generally depicted more as a rural noir, but than a horror story. Yeah. But like you say, it's everywhere. No matter what you read, you probably do read it.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, Bev, as well, you know, you're reading something, and if it's sort of quite hard on, I think, oh, this isn't particularly for me. But at the same time, you can see why it would be totally someone else's cup of tea then, you know?
Yes.
So that's for that very reason, really, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's been a lot of controversy, pardon me, in the community, so to speak.
Yeah.
Over the subject, but really, it's all valid. You know, you get some gatekeepers going, this shouldn't be there, or that shouldn't be there, we shouldn't be allowed to do this, you know, and we should be allowed to do whatever the hell we're moved to do, you know. I'm all for content warnings, but I'm not for trying to subdue what any artist wants to create, you know.
Yeah.
So, like Beverly said, there's room for everybody in this particular pool.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's so difficult to know everybody's triggers. I mean, for example, a cousin of mine has an absolute out-and-out phobia of butterflies and moths. Now, how would you ever imagine putting a content warning for that? But she absolutely cannot bear to see one, nor even a picture of one, you know, or read about them. But it's really hard to sort of, because something that might be frightening to you might not worry other people and vice versa. It's really hard to cover all eventualities, isn't it?
Yeah,
it really is.
It is, but I mean, that's quite a severe phobia then, if you can't bear to see the pictures of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I have that phobia, but not that bad.
Right.
My daughters laughed at me all the time when they were growing up, because one of them loves moths, and she was always trying to show them to me. And then once she figured out that I was terrified of them, she was always trying to show them to me 10 times more than she was before.
Shane and I had this conversation way back when we first started speaking to each other, because my fear is moths as well.
Right.
Which is just weird if you're mentioning it. But I don't know why. I think it's just that they're very fluttery and dusty, and they move quickly, and they just seem a bit senseless. But I love a butterfly. If you let a dozen butterflies free in this room now, I'd be more than happy. But if they were moths, I'd be back. I wouldn't be here. I'd be over by the door.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't, I've never, there are some moths, too, that are so bright and colorful, like butterflies, that even they don't really bother me, because they just...
No, because you think they're butterflies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think that was it. When I first started talking to Bev, she used that term, all that dusty fluttering, and it's like, yeah, that's about the most perfect fucking description I've ever heard of what bothers me about them.
You probably wouldn't have liked being in my classroom a few years back then, because I found a moth pupa. We had no idea what it would hatch into, but I took it into school and put it in a butterfly net, which is basically a sort of cage about, you know, a foot diameter, and kept it in there for about, I can't remember, it was at least a month. Thinking that the thing had died. And then one day we went in the morning with the children, and it had actually hatched overnight, and it was a bloodbath. The whole of the white net was just I couldn't believe how much blood and ooze was all, and it was a huge moth, the biggest moth I've ever seen, and the whole of the white net was just dripping in blood and gore. And then we just set it free, and we had to throw the net away because you couldn't have even washed it clean.
So that was your class's first introduction to horror then, wasn't it? But anything could have hatched from that cat. Yeah. I mean, come on, you were very brave taking it in.
Really?
It was worth the risk, though, because it was fascinating.
What age kids?
I taught everything from 3 to 11, but mainly 10 and 11-year-olds.
That'd be a great thing to come to school and see at 10 and 11 for a boy.
Yeah. What about you taught as well, didn't you?
I was in learning support for about 8 years, yes, but my class was usually like the 70 or 8-year-olds.
Yeah.
So quite a nice age group as well.
I've only ever worked with college students. I don't know if I'd have the patience for children. I mean, I love children, but I raised my children. Someone else can raise them. Well, let's talk about old rocks. old stone. I know that from talking to both of you that that's a passion.
I love anything old, like the old walls or old ruined buildings or stately houses. It's just the history of it, isn't it, Kath? It's just awe-inspiring to think of how many people may have passed by and run their hands over the stone or had conversations by walls. And yeah, I just find it fascinating.
Yeah, same. I think we're spoilt in the UK as far as that goes as well, because it's so easy. You don't have to go very far, and you can go back to 15th, 16th century.
Yes, and we are incredibly spoiled, aren't we? Very blessed.
Yeah,
really. Here, the closest you can get. I mean, you hit a wall about 200 years behind me.
Yeah.
We have no history. That's what I always get a kick out of Americans being so proud of their history. Is that? Yeah, there's something to be proud of, parts of it, but it's also not really been long enough to call it history yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that you guys can go sit on a rock that's 1,000 years old if you want to somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
It just fascinates me.
Yeah. I mean, this house that I live in now is 201 years old.
Oh.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, but Shane is freezing cold in the winter.
There is that, yeah.
Do you know the whole history of the house, then, Carl?
It's a shame in a way that this I could have shown you, but obviously that wouldn't be any good with people just listening to sound. But we've got all the handwritten documents that go back, the deeds and everything that go back to when it was built, and they're all in the beautiful cursive font.
Oh. And that's incredible.
Really big. They're almost like the old-fashioned newspaper size.
Yeah.
And we've got death certificates for previous owners because they left. They died without having children. So that, for some reason, those death certificates ended up with a solicitor as well. All physical copies, you know, nothing electronic. Mm. And we've got a big folder upstairs with everything in, so we know how much it was. You know, how much the house cost at different times of sale. Nice. We own a little parcel of land opposite that was bought for something like £70 in the 1970s.
Wow. Didn't you find something in the walls? Was it this house that you found something in the walls?
The previous owner, the day we moved in, she handed me a little old-fashioned tin. Because she had quite a bit of renovation done, though it's still really quite, you know, old. You can see it's kept sort of the period features. But the builders had found in the walls a bird skull and several little bones, which I think also belonged to the bird. And then there was an antique glass bottle stopper. And an old-fashioned cigarette box, a tiny little cigarette box. Wow. Now, apparently, they would hide bones and bird skulls in the walls in Welsh cottages as like a, you know, like a witch thing then. Do you know, it's part of keeping it safe. And they say that the bottle stoppers were often like from a spell bottle to keep the spell inside. So I don't know whether they linked, but it's really fascinating.
Oh, it really is, yeah. Oh.
Like they used them like wards, is that what?
Yeah, like wards, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they weren't, apparently, you weren't supposed to remove them. They were usually put above the lintels of doors or above fireplaces.
Stop the witches.
To remove them from you know, where they'd been hidden. But obviously, the builders had removed it, and it's just in a tin. Now I just keep it in the tin that she gave it to me, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. I just wrote all those details down because that's horrifying. I guess if you're used to traditions and you know the whole traditions around your area, probably not so much. But if I were, you know, reaching into a hole in my wall and found a bunch of bird bones and a tin box of cigarettes, I'd probably think about moving seriously.
did they make their way into a story, Kath? Have you included them in a story?
Yes, I've partly written, I'm imagining it will be a novella one day, because, but I've gone away from that one at the moment. But yes, they are sort of in the making of. I also have two antique leather chairs that we bought really cheaply, and they're sort of 1920s Art Deco. And the strange thing is that you can't see them from where I am, because they're in the other living room in there. But this is really strange. there's like, you'll polish them, right? You can clean the leather, and then you can walk in the next day, and there'll be a small circle at the back of the chair, exactly in the position where someone would have leaned their head.
Oh.
And then you can wipe that off, but within a day or two, it's back again. So I sort of linked that in with a story as well.
Wow. Yeah, I need to come and visit Kath. It's no good, is there? So I need to see it for myself.
No kidding. And not to mention, I have extreme, I guess you would call it garden envy. Kath has the loveliest yard
she
I've
has,
ever seen.
Yeah, I saw your pictures when you've been working in the other day, Kath. It looks fantastic.
Well, it's half an acre, but it's pretty much wild garden because, you know, it's not level, it's quite steep. And we've got our little areas just outside the door where we eat, and it's paved and graveled and so on. So we've tamed our area and left most of it wild because I've got 4 apple trees and a pond that's really wild where we have frogs and newts and, you know, it's full of fish. Holly tree, a lime tree. I can't know, so many, and we pretty much, and the only flowers we have are wild flowers, but then just aside then, I've got some herbs and things, you know?
Yeah, but that suits the age of the cottage, doesn't it? If it was all pristine and manicured and everything, it just wouldn't look right.
No, that's right. You can get away with a lot in an old property.
And that was the first thing that attracted me to when I was looking at the pictures, yours and that other lady's in that thread. I don't remember.
Yeah, I think it was Lynn Love, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And what I was reminded of, because I've told Bev this till I'm blue in the face. She's probably sick of hearing it, but I've done a ton of hiking in my lifetime, and my favorite place to hike is in the mountains.
Yeah.
My immediate thought when I was looking at those properties is that they reminded me of some of the mountain meadows around here.
Yeah.
You know, but you've got to get pretty damn high up to find them. No. It's like your flowers are a lot easier to look at.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that's I'm always attracted to those more wild green spaces like that.
Yeah, it just attracts the wildlife as well, which is nice.
Essentially, anything. I'm envious of every single thing over there that you guys have that I don't have. So that covers a lot of conversation time there.
You can't possibly envy our weather, Shane. It's impossible. Too much rain.
I live in Portland, Oregon. So yeah, I'm not too intimidated by rain. rain all the time here.
Oh, never.
We've been not really fortunate, but we've been kind of, you know, if you hate rain, we've been lucky for a couple of years now that's been very light. The unfortunate side being that we really need the rain, you know. It gets ugly around here if we go for a long time without rain. Then we have a bunch of rain. Hills start sliding into valleys and things, you know.
Yeah.
Oh. Can't believe I'm referring to my notes so much. I know the answer to this with Bev. And I talked to her about it on Ink Heist, the other podcast. And where the hell did it go? Sorry. Okay, it's back. Catherine, are you, talk about your process some. Are you, like a pantser or a plotter, an outliner, that sort of thing?
I'm definitely a pantser, which is the strangest thing is, like if you speak to people who know me really well in real life, they actually make fun of me because I'm so sort of organized. Everything has to be done yesterday. I'm really awful in my, you know, everyday life, especially when I was working. I'm a bit more laid back now since finishing work. But as far as writing goes, I'm a real pantser. I'll just get an inspiration from somewhere. either it can be a dream, it can be a powerful first line, but more often than not, it's an image, you know, because you know my husband does photography, and we'll go walk in the coast path and come across something, like there's an abandoned cottage just literally over the road from us. It can be anything, you know, and so then I get an inspiration for a story and just literally start writing and then hit a brick wall and have a huge panic. And then I just go away and I just have to be, well, either go for a walk or go and lie in a quiet room and just picture the scene, because I'm not a very visual learner at all. I'm much more auditory than visual. So I have to literally go and close my eyes and imagine the characters in the setting and imagine the scene. And then it sort of tells me what would come next. Really, really stuck. I refer to Tony and see if he can help me out, because that's the worst thing about being a pantser, is you just don't know where the story's going.
Yeah, but that's the best thing about being a pantser as well, is the fact that you don't know where the story's going.
Yeah.
I agree. I've never written anything with a plan that worked out for me.
No.
In
early days, I tried planning a bit more, but I always ended up changing it anyway, so it was pointless.
Yeah, like, the Ohio author Tiffany McDaniel said, for her, and I realized for me after talking to her about it, because I was stagnating, I was trying really hard to write that important outline for everything I was trying to write. And she said, that's for me, that the outline blows my creativity. I've written the story and I'm done. And I just want to move on to a new one.
Well, I'm kind of similar, Kath, in the fact that with a novel, I'll always have a beginning and I'll always know my ending. And I'll maybe know a few points in between. But apart from that, I'm very character-driven. I just let the characters take me where they want the story to go. And so sometimes those points in the middle can just get blown out of the water. But with short stories, I just get an idea like you and I just run with it and see where it takes me.
Yeah. And you really get those eureka moments, you sort of almost clapping your hands with joy when something that you don't expect either, you know, they are telling the story to you and it's a lovely feeling. But by the same token, it can get quite depressing when you totally hit a wall as well, can't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to outline. One of my best writer friends is an absolute, you know, stickler for writing an outline, and even to the fact of writing the outlines for each character in each story. And she said, well, it's so much easier because then you know exactly what you're writing. And I'm like, well, where's the joy in that if you know exactly what's coming?
Yeah,
I struggle with that. As a visual artist and a writer, although I'm not very good with the visual art, I struggle with not knowing where it's going, but I struggle more with realism, where I, you know, with visuals. And I think about that with outlines versus pantsing too, that you kind of have a realistic snapshot of something or versus an abstract of something, you know. And that's really, really the difference, I think, for me, is that it feels like art if I don't know where I'm going.
Absolutely, Yeah.
And the creative process is different for everybody. I mean, I get very fed up when people start spouting, oh, you're not a real writer if you don't do it like this, or you don't write for so many hours a day.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just crazy. Whatever works for you is the right process.
Yeah, definitely. And probably you're the same. I keep notepads everywhere.
Yes, notepads everywhere.
And even in the bedside drawer. And if a line, it might be a line or it might be just an idea, and it comes to you at any time of day, you just jot it down or tap it into a notepad on the phone.
Yeah,
I'm lazy. Alexa, take a note. No, not now. She listens. I always forget to turn it off. And she tries to talk to my TV when it says the word Alexa.
So. Oh, right. Well, the last time we spoke, Shane, didn't your tablet start playing music halfway through our conversation or something?
Yes, it did. Exactly. And that was when she thought, okay, playing this. Thank you, but Yeah, so I usually turn that off because I get distracted so easily, obviously. Then I have my neighbors contribute to the distraction too, because they like to make a lot of sound.
Yeah.
Oh, this is fun. I thought about this the other night. We were talking about moth.
Yes, my moth. Yeah, from my Gable Downpot series, yeah.
And talking about appearances. I remember you showed me something. This is the closest I've come to what he might look like.
Yes.
But talk about that. Who do you think, if you were to compare your characters, I guess you'd have to say to real life people, say if you were going to cast the making of Gabriel Davenport.
Oh, God, that is such a hard question. I would say, but he's too old now, but if we could go back probably about, let me think, 7 years, Asa Butterfield I would have cast as Gabriel, because he just had that kind of look and he had dark hair. But I've never found anybody that I would look at and think, oh, yeah, he could play Moth or he could play Teal. I mean, that photo that I showed you was taken, I don't even know where I got it from. I think it was for some hairdressing site on Pinterest. I think I got that from.
That's funny. I was looking at that very thing, different samples of hairstyles that you can show to a hairstylist. But it was just because I got that same thought. Well, I bet I could find the type of guy I'm looking for right here in this book. but not really. They were all too emo for me.
Well, that's half the time it's because you're just I'm just too picky, you know, because you have this image in your head and it's this absolutely perfect image, and you'd be very, very lucky to walk down the street and see somebody that you thought would work, and then it would be awful because I want to stalk them. Hello, are you an actor? Would you like to be in my movie? No, we're not going to go there.
Yeah. Catherine, same thing.
You're going to have to help me out, you, because Eleanor, the main character in Immortelle, I see her played by, but I've forgotten her name, the main actress in Penny Dreadful.
Oh, yeah.
Eva Green.
Mm-hmm. Eva Green.
Oh, yeah. I loved Penny Dreadful. That was a fabulous series.
I did too.
Fabulous. Yeah.
I was terribly sad when it...
Quite serious, like Eva Green's character.
Yeah.
Actually, I can see that too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have a major love for that show.
Oh yeah.
It was just wonderful, wasn't it? I mean, every season was really good.
Yeah.
Which maybe makes it a good thing that they stopped when they did, even though it just about made me cry.
Yes. Yeah, they could have dragged it on for like 7 or 8 seasons, and that's never a good thing, no matter how good the sort of the base project is. Once you've dragged it further than 4 or 5 seasons, it's not any good.
I agree. Anything like that, it's like I have nothing against zombies, but I can't imagine how these people have been watching Walking Dead for 10 years. You know, it's like I watched that series for 3 years and I enjoyed it, and then I stopped enjoying it because you can only rehash the same story so many times.
Yeah,
but the Walking Dead is a comic series, isn't it? So I'm guessing they had a lot of material to work from.
Yeah. They still do. They haven't even touched the surface of the material they have to work from. Mm-hmm. That was I don't know about the UK, but it was a ridiculously popular series here.
Oh, it was here. I mean, I think I watched the first 5 or 6 series, and then they kept killing off my favorite characters, which is never a good thing. And then I didn't care about the other ones that came afterwards.
Yeah.
That was my problem too. And it was like they were the only purpose for killing them off was because they were your favorite characters and they wanted to get an
A series I love, though, and I really wish they had done more, though it might have destroyed it as well, was Carnival.
Oh, I remember Carnival, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was really good.
It was. Yeah. Quite bizarre horror, wasn't it?
It's, yes, you know, it was.
Fabulous. One of my favourites. We have it on DVD, so we've watched it a few times.
Yeah, did they do two seasons of that, Cal?
I think it was two, wasn't it? If I remember.
Yeah, and then they just said they weren't making any more for whatever reason it was. But they could bring that one back, definitely.
Yeah, it's fabulous. Yeah, so bizarre, the characters. They're the sort of characters I like to write about.
Yes, so interesting, aren't they?
Yeah.
I need to find that. I have not seen that show, I don't think. Yeah.
Oh, you would love it, Shane. You would love it.
Yeah, I think it's, what would it have been, Bev? 90s?
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
I'm not sure. 2000-ish, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I could have seen it because I don't remember things that far back very well.
Yeah.
It's like I can read a book I read 4 years ago and it's a brand new book to me. So.
Yeah.
One of the benefits to the way my brain works. Everything's new after, you know, everything reboots after a couple of years.
Yeah, nice.
Well, that's good in a way, because then you can read your favorite books over and over again and they can still surprise you.
Yeah.
Okay, all done with that. Do you, I know the answer to this with Beverly. Do you write by hand or do you write on your computer, Kat?
Computer. I can't, I'm like, my handwriting is like a doctor's. It's totally illegible. Awful. I struggle to write a greetings card. Thankfully, I haven't got many people left in my family to write them for. I think died. Or a lot of us have just decided the greetings cards are a commercial waste of money, so we don't bother. Probably send them to my dad, and he loves a handwritten message. You know what the oldies are like, they're quite sort of sentimental. And I really have to focus not to make mistakes. And I write shopping lists and I really can't understand my writing. It's awful.
Yes, I sometimes I do things like if I'm on a podcast and I know they're going to ask me maybe kind of more awkward or more in-depth questions, I'll make notes. And I have the notes here and I'm looking at them and I can't read what I've written because I've kind of done them like in shorthand. And when I was writing them, I knew exactly what was on the pad. But now looking at them, it's like, not much help. Yeah, like that. Yeah, exactly like that.
Well, what I do, Bev, is I type them up, especially some podcasts ask you questions beforehand, don't they? They tell you what they, you know, and I send it to my Kindle and then I have the Kindle by the side of my computer.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Well done.
Yeah, I do too, but I'd never thought of doing that. My Kindle's always right there, but I never actually thought about having my notes there. I always have my other laptop over here with things on it. But I kind of crashed it this morning when I was trying to solve my sound issues. So
will write a whole draft in pen, won't they?
Yeah, I know people that write the whole book in a notepad and then transcribe it onto the computer.
I know Brandon Scott does it because he's got a thing for fountain pens. He collects fountain pens and the inks and everything. And he sometimes posts pictures of a whole manuscript, all in capital letters as well.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't cope.
And Vit LeMay writes in hand as well, I think, doesn't she?
Who?
Vit LeMay from, she writes, doesn't she, all in, and then transcribes it all.
Yeah.
I can't anymore. My hand gets too damn sore if I try to write for long periods of time. It used to be the only way I would write because, you know, I grew up with no other way to do so.
Yeah.
And I spent all of college sitting in bars with a yellow legal pad and a pen, you know. And gloriously no cell phone or any other way to connect with the outside world while I was working, you know.
Yeah.
It seems almost more romantic, though, when you're a poet to be writing longhand, doesn't it?
Yeah. I write the vast majority of my poetry longhand still. But prose doesn't work for me. The thing with writing poetry longhand, though, is it slows you down and it makes your brain kind of slide over and manipulate the words a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So,
Yeah. Yeah.
The bad thing about me with handwriting is like half of it's in cursive and half of it's printed. because my brain is so erratic, it's like half the time it's like writing away and then it switches mid-word to printing away. I'm not ending this. I just know I'll forget to mention this. I do this to people all the time. The House of Little Bones coming out approximately.
September, the end of September. I should have the date this week sometime, and the pre-order should be up.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that late September.
And I'll have a review going up on Ink Heist of that soon, as well as Immortelle, which comes out when, Kevin?
July, 15th of July, so just under 4 weeks, is it?
Ooh, exciting, Kath.
I know. Oh, nerve-wracking as well.
And that's interesting, too, about Off-Limits. I mentioned that earlier. They don't really make mistakes, you know. And they've got guys, that's evidenced by their first publication, which was Laurel Hightower's Crossroads.
Oh, Laurel's Crossroads,
You can't mention a horror novella in the past 3 years and not mention that one if you're talking about
it. Yeah, I mean, everything they touch is gold, isn't it?
Yeah, so. Yeah. And, you know, Jennifer Susie, there's so many different ones. Like, I'm drawing a blank, really.
Greg Sisko,
is it? Greg Sisko, Hayley Piper.
Piper. Eric LaRocca in September with his collection.
Yeah. She released the cover of that today. It looks fabulous.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, I just did the cover reveal was today, wasn't it, on that one? Really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Look that up. Anytime it says Off Limits on it, I kind of start looking forward to it without even knowing who it is, really. I would. And that's another question. Who do you think is a bucket list publisher for you in the indie markets?
Oof, gosh, that's hard.
Okay, that's not a fair question, because then you have to name a favorite.
We have to name, and then we might not name the right ones, and then you'd feel bad if you didn't name the one that you really thought.
It's difficult because there are several really good indie presses out there, and I still consider myself fairly new, and I'm discovering new ones every day.
Yes.
I also made the name of one down today that I sort of saw on Twitter, that open for submissions, and I'd never heard of them before, although when I looked at what books they've published then, I recognised some of the books, you know?
Yeah.
But, I had a flash piece published by Flame Tree, which was lovely. Actually, that was a short story, was it? No, it was Flash, yeah, in their monthly newsletter. And I've had a Flash piece with Crystal Lake. You have too, Bev?
I had a Flash with Crystal Lake, yeah.
Yeah, and it was off limits for me, really. I still pinch it myself.
Yeah.
did you submit then in the open submission period?
Yeah, she announced. Samantha announced that she was open. I mean, she opens quite, you know, for a short period. And my novella was read. Well, it was ready when she announced she was going to be opening. I sort of, you know, shot to try and get it finished in time, which I did. And then I sent the first however many pages, I can't remember now because it was quite a while back. And literally within, I think it was 3 days, I had an email from her saying how much she loved it and could I send the rest. And then I only waited about 3 weeks and she offered me, you know, the publication.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, it was fab.
Especially that 3 weeks thing.
Yeah, not like 9 months, like some publishers say. We'll tell you in 9 months.
Yeah, well, I submitted one. I won't name them. I submitted, well, it was 9 months ago, and apparently their waiting list is at least a year at the moment.
That's just ridiculous. I mean, I understand, but just close your call, I kind of think. You know?
Yeah.
Because I did that the other day. I found a listing of Flash Fiction calls. Been into Flash Fiction lately. But some of them were like, you know, if you haven't heard from us in a year, then go ahead and feel free to contact us. And it's like, if I haven't heard from you in a year, I've already sold that sucker to somebody else. Sorry, I didn't tell you, you know.
That's one of the cons, isn't it, of traditional publishing, in the fact that the wait time, even between them saying yes, they'll take your story to actual publication, is years.
I don't know that people understand that either, how unimportant the money is compared to the art with most of us. That, you know, okay, all the stuff I've got out there waiting for publication, I've already been paid for it. But I'd give all that money back if they'd just publish it today. You know? Because, I mean, all that really bought me is, you know, a couple of books and a bottle of whiskey. So
that's
Well, we'll never be rich. Writers are never rich, are they? And unless they move in the echelon of, you know, Stephen King and people like that. But no, we write for the art, don't we, really?
Yeah.
And whatever bit that we manage to claw back is just a bonus. And then that just gets ploughed into, you know, like covers and editing and everything like that. So we don't really make much money on it.
No. I'm so lucky with Tony that I don't have to pay for any of the artwork, you know, because you know he does.
He's so good, and that book trailer for Immortal is wonderful, Carl.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as well, because people have so much ready access to media and movies these days, I don't think they realise how much work goes into something even like that. Even though it's 2.5 minutes long.
Yeah, 2.5 minutes.
I mean, that literally was months of work. And he started working on the trailer quite a while before I even said the story, because we just assumed that I would be self-publishing it. You know, it was only afterwards. So I saw Samantha's call. And when I had the chat to Samantha, when she first, we had a chat online. And I said to her, I said, you know, I hope you don't mind, but my husband Tony's sort of like 3/4 of the way through making me a trailer. Will that be okay? You know, because he put so much effort into it already. And he wrote the music himself as well.
He's just so creative.
Yeah, and that's why I'm fortunate I don't have to pay out for any of that at all, you know.
Well, he did the fabulous trailer for the charity anthology we were both involved with at the beginning of last year, Diabolica Britannica, and I still remember that was just a wonderful trailer.
Yeah.
That's Keith Anthony Baird.
Anthony Baird, that's right. That's how Kath and I first met, wasn't it, through there?
Yeah, and I think, like most of you in the Antho, have become really good friends. It was definitely worth doing, if only for that reason. It was
And then he's got the Diabolica Americana coming out soon.
Yeah.
I've actually had the opportunity to beta read a couple of those stories, and that's going to be a good one. I need to pick up the Britannica one because it's he's got a good eye, and the people that he's inviting and the people that he's accepting, you know, blind submissions from are so far are just stellar.
No, I think you definitely enjoy Diabolica. It's there's a very good cross section, isn't it, Kath? I think of British talent.
Taste for appeal to everybody's tastes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because we've got Janine with a splatterpunk, and then yours is more gothic.
Mine's gothic, yeah.
You know, there's Ali's and Steph's and John.
Morgan.
It's Morgan Tanner.
Sarah.
Yeah. Lovely bunch of people.
I think that if I had a bucket list press, it would be Grey Matter Press, just because they're the reason I started doing everything I started doing way, way back. God, I think 2013 now. When their first book came out, it was the first book that I reviewed. And then I started talking with Tony Rivera and John Tapp and other guys who were in that book, you know, Michelle Garza and a bunch of other people that just turned out to be really, really, really good and fairly well-known indie authors, you know.
Yeah.
But just they've just treated me really good over the years, so it kind of is a... But the thing about that is it doesn't matter how close Tony Rivera is to you, if he doesn't like your work, he'll tell you you suck.
But that's fine, isn't it? I mean, yep. you don't want nepotism. You just want to be included if your work is good enough, not because you know happen to know somebody that runs the press.
Exactly.
Are they often open for submissions, Shane, or is it very rare?
I think they just opened to submissions again. I'm pretty sure graymatterpress.com is the website.
Yeah.
And they spell gray right, so.
And is there all types of horror then? Quiet horror as well, or just?
He's gone all over the board. Horror, right. Crime, quiet horror, splatterpunk.
Right.
You know, he's published Karen Runge and Ray Garden, who tend to get very, very, you know, graphic, especially Garden.
Right.
But he's also published some very quiet horror writers too, like John Tapp.
Mm.
And so, yeah, all over the board. And I don't know what he's open to, whether it's, I think it's probably long form fiction right now, knowing Tony. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, Tony, if you don't have any openings, blame Kath. I didn't say anything. The indie market is remarkable, though. On so many levels, I was talking to Rich Duncan the other night about that. And, I mean, like, this podcast is a prime example. Because, like we've talked about, none of us are making any money. I don't have money to spend for, like you were talking about, for graphics and things like that. Music. So when I was putting together this podcast, I contacted musicians I know and artists I know and other people and said, let me barter services, and got all of my assets from professionals in their industries just because they know what I'm doing and they know that I'm not making any money doing it, just like them. And, you know, so I think that's the primary thing that keeps me coming back again and again and again to the indies, is that you have that ability. You know, everybody's willing to chip in and help each other out.
Yeah. It is. It's a fabulous community in the fact that everybody tries to help each other out.
Yeah. And then and things like critique partners and things like that. You get beyond the indies and you can actually end up spending a good chunk of money having people critique your work for you.
I agree with you though, Shane, completely, you know, and I always say to Tony is so much mutual respect for people like yourself who are willing to give their time for no other reason than the love of it, basically, you know, and we would be lost without you because we don't, as indie writers, you know yourself because you work both sides of the coin. You don't have a marketing company behind you. You don't have any help. So unless we help each other, we sort of just lost in the crowd.
We'd be shouting into the void, wouldn't we, Kath?
Really?
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, you'll see me latch on to certain writers and certain publishers and things like that. If I come across a publisher that I really, really love, I really, really want them to stay in business.
Yeah.
And so the best thing you can do is help them.
And buy their work. Yeah.
Help them spread the word about their work. Do anything you can to make sure that people are still spending money on their work so that you can spend your money on it, too.
That's the thing. I think you're saying about we make very little money, and what we do make, we tend to buy each other's books.
We do, absolutely. Yeah, it's like, oh, look, somebody bought my book today. That means I can buy somebody else's book.
Exactly.
For a week goes by, I suppose if I had to average it out, I buy at least two a week, most weeks. You know, it's crazy, really.
I know. I always end up buying much more than I can actually read. And then I'll have a period where I'll go, I'm not buying anymore because I have shelf fulls of books and my Kindle's groaning. And then somebody will bring out a release and it'll be like, oh, I'll just buy this one. One more won't hurt.
I'm exactly the same. And then you feel guilty for those who still haven't got around to reading and reviewing.
Yeah.
Because I do review every single book, unless it's a very rare occasion when it's a DNF. I mean, yes. I do review every book I read because I know how important that is as well, but it's so hard to get reviews.
I always try to at least, if I'm not going to write a full review, I at least try to jump over on Goodreads and give a star rating.
That's right.
Readers, all readers want to know is, yeah, I dug this book.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
You know, some people, more academic minded people, will sit there and read one of my reviews, which are ridiculously long, I've been told. But I learned from Pipino Iglesias, and everybody loves him, so I'll take it. You know?
Yeah.
But the vast majority of readers don't care about awards, and they don't care about long reviews. If you've got a super long review, they're going to page down to the bottom most times and go, did he like it or did he not like it?
People have such busy lives and their attention span seems to be quite short, so maybe they just haven't got time to read half a page of a review. They'll say, oh, it's given it 5 stars, and they'll scan down the paragraph that you have written or the 4 lines you have written, and that's enough for them to know that if you like the book, then they probably would as well.
I think so. And I think that's the most important thing beyond that. Once you've just said, I really liked this book, give it a try, you know. I lost my train of thought. Sorry. I preamble too much and then I distract myself.
Well, it's kind of like Sadie Hartman, Mother Horror, is that she has built her following by being very, very good at what she does. And now people will just look at Sadie and see what she's reviewed, and they know that if she enjoys it, they're going to enjoy it too. That's why she's such a good spokesperson for the community.
Yeah.
And that's what I was going to say, is that word of mouth is huge, huge when it comes to selling.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
I always tell people my words on Twitter are more important than my words in a review on my website by a long shot. I've had about 10% as many people say, I bought this book because of your review, as I have say, I bought this because of what you said on Twitter.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Just gossip, you know? If you're really good at gossiping, you're helping authors if you're talking about their books. So.
Yeah, because especially it's a thing about, you have to say something, is it 7 times before it's logged into your brain that you might actually want to buy it? And if your book is continually being promoted by people like you, Shane, on Twitter, people then will start to recognize it and maybe want to give it a try for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And if people underestimate the power of a review, they need to think again, because I'll just give you an example. I think it was last Sunday when we were away, Josh Marcella tweeted that he'd finished Mr. Megalith, and he tweeted his review. And that day I sold 6 copies.
Yes.
Yeah.
They really do work.
They do, absolutely. I always notice an uptake in my sales if somebody has, you know, reviewed it on Twitter and you know, it's been retweeted a couple of times.
And the
numbers are actually quantifiable. You can ask a publisher or an author, they can tell you, yes, I see a visible change on days that somebody's paying attention to my book.
Definitely.
Which isn't a point to brag about, it's just a point that it's really not that hard to do, you know.
No.
But also, it takes a lot of time and dedication, too. It's like, Sadie Hartman is my fucking hero.
Oh, Sadie's fabulous, yeah.
She is out there. I mean, she kicks ass. She's got so many irons in the fire.
She has, yeah.
She's so incredibly good at all of them, everything she does. And in addition to that, she's just a hell of a good person and a hell of a good friend. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel very lucky to have met Sadie way back when she wasn't Mother Hower, when she was she was Sadie Reads Them All on Buxton Crown. That's where we met. 2015.
When I met her, she was Sadie Lou Who.
Oh, Sadie. Oh, yes.
And that was just probably 2016-17, I think. But, yeah, she's just... I couldn't keep up with her. Everything she does and does so well, you know, and then being, you know, like a primary example is like 6 months or so ago, I was having some issues with someone that I was complaining about, and Sadie messaged me and said, here's my phone number, call me. And then just talk to me, just listen to me, you know. I was like, okay. You don't get that from a lot of people, you know.
No.
That's right. I've only known Sadie for about a year, Bev, since the Diabolica, because I can remember speaking to you about, you know, about that. And I was so thrilled when she invited me to do one of those videos for her birthday celebration.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And she realises how much it means, you know. Because she's just... many followers, she, you know, it's hard for her to keep in contact with all of us, but it definitely made my day.
I did mine too. I was honestly stunned when she, because she had sent me an email asking me to, and it went to my spam for some reason. And then I was seeing, she said something about having, you know, anybody that she missed to contact her. And I contacted her, and she says, well, I already invited you, and you ignored me. Well, hell no, I didn't.
The moral of the story is always check your spam messages daily.
Absolutely. I passed on a publication that way, because I didn't check my spam.
Yeah.
They don't like it when you don't respond to them.
No.
Well, somebody pick a topic. I'm out of things.
Writing influences, Kath. Who was your biggest influence?
I have that note.
You see, again, now that's a tricky one, because I'm not very loyal when it comes to my favourites. I have got certain authors who are just an auto-buy for me. I love Joanne Harris. I love Neil Gaiman. Lots and lots. But I tend to like have favourite books, which really resonate with me, rather than a particular author. Some of my favourite books are Eowyn Ivey's The Snow Child.
Oh, I love that one.
It's fabulous, isn't it?
Wonderful book.
Laura Purcell. I love Laura Purcell's work. Oh, good grief, so many. But like Sarah Perry. Lots and lots.
You'll think about loads after we finish. You'll say, oh, I should have mentioned this person. That's what happens when you're put on the spot, isn't it?
But I'm not like, you know, I have read Stephen King, obviously. I doubt if there's many people who haven't. But I'm not really like necessarily I'll buy everything by that particular author. It depends. I'm definitely drawn by the blurb. Even if it's one of my favourite authors, if I don't really fancy the blurb, then it's an awe for me.
Yes.
I'm the same way. Titles, too. I'm really picky about titles. I don't know why, but I don't consciously not buy a book because of the title, but I know that I do subconsciously all the time.
Yeah. I think creatives are like that, though. If we don't like the cover, or we don't like the title, or I don't know why. It seems like something that we should just gloss over and just read the blurb or read the first page of the book.
Right.
But if it doesn't call to you by looking at the cover, it's very easy to pass it by.
Yeah. More about you then, you both. Have you got absolute favourites?
I read a lot of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle when I was sort of in my teenage years. Because back then we didn't have a YA, did we, Kathy? You went straight from middle grade to adult roles. And the Hound of the Baskervilles was the first story ever to scare me, so that has a very fond place in my heart. Neil Gaiman and the magical realism that he writes. Anne Rice for her vampire fiction.
Yeah.
So many modern authors, I wouldn't like to take a guess because I'd miss somebody out.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I had that same note sitting here, but it's buried in all my scribbles about the influences. Me? I'm supposed to be interviewing you guys. No. That's actually the intention for This Is It eventually is going to be kind of a round table type setup, but which has always been the way with me because I don't have any sense of organization.
I know we all share a fondness for certain poets like Dylan Thomas, though, don't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Thomas is my number one poetry influence, probably. Yeah. Dylan Thomas, Sylvia Plath, T.S. Eliot. Those are the people who sank to my heart when I was a kid and made me want to write.
Yeah.
Pablo Neruda is one of mine.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
There you go, Shane.
Yeah. I always have that book in my James Wright books someplace where I can just pick them up and read them. James Wright is a Ohio poet. He's the one that people who've read him tell me that my work is most like.
Right.
James Wright.
Yeah.
I don't see it. But you never see it.
I don't think you see it in yourself as a writer. If somebody compares you to another writer, I think it's very difficult to actually see it yourself.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the question then. I like to sort of experiment a little bit as well. So, like, for example, it was Kathy Koja's Velocities short story collection that inspired me to write Lua. You know, the one set on the mountain, in Mists of Megalith, the one with the guy fishing.
I love that one, Kath. It was so dark, but it was just very good.
First dabble at second person writing, and it was one of her stories. I can't remember the title of the short now, but it was in Velocities, and it was a second person narrative. And I just thought, wow, this is just amazing. I've got to have a go at second person. And so it was her inspiration that inspired that particular story. So there's lots of different things. And I find Michael Sellers, he's quite Michael Sellers on Twitter, he's I think he's from Liverpool, he's the best guy, and he writes quite like Kathy Koja to me, and I've told him that. I don't know whether he sees that himself, like you say, you know?
Probably doesn't, though.
Kathy Koja is brilliant. Sorry, I interrupted you anyway. I had a little delay there, so I thought everybody was dead talking. The Cipher is a must read by Kathy.
Yeah.
But also, if you get a chance to talk to her, be on a panel with her or on a podcast or anything, she is the most wonderful person in the world.
Yeah, she seems it.
Yeah, she does.
I was really lucky with Tony as well because he did the art competition for the Cypher, you know, the Cypher art competition.
Oh, we did. That's right.
I said to him as soon as I just read the book, and I said, as soon as I saw the competition, right, I've got a job for you. You've got to do me a picture to go with this. So I read the book out loud to him because he doesn't actually read. He was an avid reader all his life, but because of his eyesight, he struggles with text. Because I've said about his eye issues. So I often read aloud to him. So I read the cipher to him. And then luckily, he did the picture and it won. So
I know.
Of the cipher signed on the necklace and everything, I was elated.
Oh, that's a wonderful prize to win, isn't it?
And that reminds me of what we were talking about earlier with presses. Meerkat Press are fabulous as well. Everything weird fiction, but fabulous.
I have Tricia from Meerkat.
Yeah.
And J.S. Rupalar, I always pronounce her name wrong, I'm sure. We'll be guests on this podcast very soon. And I couldn't agree more with you, Kat. I have read a bunch of stuff by them, and I have not been disappointed by any of it. She's another one who's got that incredible eye. Particularly when it comes to magical realism.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and I'm going to try to get you to host on that one too, Beverly.
All right, okay then. No pressure, Shay. No pressure at all.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, I found one of my buried notes that was important to me. You briefly touched on it earlier when we were talking about old stone edifices and whatnot, you know, old ruins and things. How many of the locations in your stories are based on places that you actually have
quite
been to?
Quite a few. In The Making of Gabriel Davenport, the church, St. Jude's Church, and the Lich Gate was the church in the next village to me where I used to live. Mm. The Switchback Hill, where Olivia's car goes off the road, is a hill that I used to drive down quite often. Westport Quay, my made-up town in The Shining in the Shadows and The Purity of Crimson, is based on a kind of a culmination of the French Quarter of New Orleans merged with an English seaside village. But a lot of the landmarks there are actually landmarks I took from those places. Mm. And in The Ruin of Delicate Things, the house in the lake is based on a National Trust site that I used to live near as well. So, yeah, locations, I like to use real locations if I can. I think it grounds the story.
Yeah. The same for me. Immortelle is set in Mont, a little seaside, well, it's a tiny little hamlet in Mont that actually is just a farm and a little white church, which you'll know if you've seen the trailer, the trailer's actually filmed in the church. So obviously I needed to have more houses and a vicarage and so on. Mm. So I sort of merged it with a few other villages that are nearby on the coast. And then in Mists of Megalith, most of those settings are real. Mm, you know, there's Carrick Sampson, the Cromlech on the coast, and the lake in Lua, Mynydd Epin, to Fishing Lake, really, really remote, high in the mountains of Mid Wales. In the Ice House, Bedwelty House, is actually real. All of that is real. Most of them, probably 80% actually. And I've actually written a novel, which I'm currently subbing. I wrote it about 2 years ago, but I've been editing and in between other projects, which I'm subbing at the moment, that's actually set here in this house. And at the back of the house, there's a lane, a disused lane now, that leads right the way up the mountain to a farm. It doesn't go anywhere else. It's not a public right of way. That novel is actually set here, right here.
Oh, wow.
It's very sort of, true to life for me. And that's got the main character, who's a 10-year-old girl who has Down syndrome.
Oh, gosh, that sounds really good.
She lives with her dad, and the mother is an actor and dancer who really didn't want anything to do with her, not because of her condition, just because her mother's a narcissist.
Yeah.
So it's Hannah's sort of, you know, coming to terms with those issues as well as her problems then.
Well, I hope it's picked up very soon and we all get a chance to read it, Kat.
It's a real difficult sell, Bev, you know, because you hear people say, you know, they want original voices, but then when it comes to people who actually have learning disabilities, you really don't read much fiction, which
just doesn't
play characters, and it's such a shame, you know, because I feel I've got her voice right, because I taught children with Downs and children
with... Yes, so that you know, you're not just plucking something out of the ether.
Yeah.
And I think it's important, especially with kind of touchy characters like that. Like someone, you know, a lot of my characters have neurodiverse issues, you know, but I've lived it, I've counseled other people. It's just been a part of my life and something I'm very vocal about. But I don't know if it was Bev or Rich or who it was I just was talking about that, that it needs to be, I like the idea that you're actually being inclusive that way and remembering that there's another marginalized group out there.
I think it might have been me, Shane, a few nights ago.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. We never talk to each other anymore, so. Sorry. This one. Okay, so basically I keep asking these questions that pop into my head and pretending like I'm interviewing you, but I'm actually taking lessons. Because I've never thought about that. I mean, I thought about it, but I've never been real good about, like, I try to place stories and poems and things like that here in Portland, because, I mean, I've lived here for almost 50 years, and I can't. I have no alacrity for writing what I know.
Right.
So virtually everything has been made up except for, I mean, natural places, outdoor places, things like that. Those are all real. But, yeah, otherwise it's just, everything's just fantasy.
Yeah.
Can't do it. But the other question was, is it common, you mentioned earlier, and I've heard other authors mention it, that, like, you were working on this story, but you've got it set aside for now. I have probably 20 of those. I mean, I have 3 novels in the works and a novella, and I've got several stories and always a bunch of poetry. Yeah. Is that a common thing?
I tend to have one main project and then 2 or 3 kind of various stages of maybe one being drafted and one resting and maybe one going through a second edit. But I like to have just one main project and my others maybe basically be poetry or short stories. I'm not very good at sort of juggling 2 or 3 like novels or novellas together. I find that all the characters seem to want to shout at me at the same time, which can get very confusing.
Yeah,
I'm similar to Bev. A longer piece, the one I just spoke about with the little girl who has Down syndrome, I mean, that's been complete for about a year, apart from it needed, you know, more rounds of editing. So that's sort of on a, you know, it's done and dusted, basically. And like I said, I'm submitting it. I recently started what I imagine will turn out to be a novella rather than a novel. But that's only about 6,000 words in. But I will come away from those longer pieces to do short stories. I love writing short stories. Mm. My heart very much lies with short stories. But like you, Bev, I wouldn't come away and start another long work. I couldn't do that either.
Yeah, I can't. Well, I kind of misspoke because I can't either. If I'm working on a long piece, I'm only working on one.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I do sometimes hit, sometimes we'll hit a wall. And then I'll just put them away and work on a different one for a while.
Yeah.
Because I get too frustrated, and if I go long enough in that mode, I'll just round file it.
That's right.
Yeah, I was listening to Hayley Piper last week on Ross Jeffries' podcast, and she was saying the same. If she's working on one piece and it's not speaking to her, she'll go away and work on something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like we talked about earlier, whatever works for the end.
Absolutely. Whatever works for you.
Yeah.
I was Tim Wagner, when he was on Ink Heist, we were talking about his book on writing. I can't remember the name of now.
Yeah.
Writing in the Dark.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that is what it is. Yeah. And he said, pay close attention to all the advice that I give you, but when you walk away, only use the parts that work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, yeah, those are words to live by as a writer. You do want to listen to the advice, but you don't want to take every piece of advice you get.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, no, it'd be far too confusing to take everybody's advice.
Yeah.
And what worked for some, and it goes back, you know, the outlining issue is a perfect example of that, is I've had every teacher I ever had said write an outline. And even some of my instructors, when I was taking creative writing lessons, said I should do that with even my poetry. It's I didn't take any of that to heart because I knew it didn't work for me. You know, I just said okay and did it in class. But it's kind of the same thing. Just because that you say that works for you doesn't mean that it's gospel and it's going to work for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm rambling now.
No, that's right. I mean, I know from the point of view of teaching, you probably say the same, Bev. You know, you have syllabus. They insist that we teach children how to plan to write.
Yes.
And that, you know, they need a beginning and a middle and an end, and they need this. And I used to do it because I was told I had to do it. You had to have the evidence there in their workbooks of that planning phase for them, to get their grades. And I used to feel guilty, not forcing it, but you know what I mean. And they'd come up to me and say, like, they might have written their beginning, and they'll say, "Miss, in my plan, I intend doing this, but can I change it and do that?" And I used to say, "Of course you can. It's your story, you know." Mm-hmm. Because it's a shame then, because it's taken away from the creative process, isn't it?
Yes, which is what we're trying to encourage them to do, is create something.
But the government, in all its glory, just still won't allow teachers to do what they know fundamentally works.
Yes.
Yeah.
Editing.
Oh, editing.
I don't want to go in too deep on this subject as far as what people talk about online, but how do you guys feel about editing yourself versus using a professional editor?
I always edit my first draft, and then it will go to either my critique partners or it will go to my editor for a manuscript evaluation, and then I get that back, and then I'll do another two rounds of editing on it before it goes to my beta readers, and then another round before it goes back to my editor for final line edit. So I usually go through 5 or 6 rounds of editing.
I self-edit time and time again, lots of strategies. Reading aloud, I can't stress how important.
Yes, that's very important.
And I think I learned that from being a teacher. I read to Tony. He's very, very critical. If something doesn't work, or if a certain word, anything just doesn't work or jars, he's very strict and tells me. I've got one or two beta readers that use for short stories, or for The Wolf and Favour, the novel I was talking about, that has gone to 2 beta readers, even though it's full length. Mm. And they're both wonderful. One of them looked at it more from an editing point of view, and one more from a content point of view. So their feedback was invaluable. But for example, with Immortelle, it was totally 100% self-edited. But I'll sort of copy and paste it in a different font, some sort of jarring font, and put it on the Kindle and read it out loud, and I probably go through at least 7 times of reading the whole script.
You get to the point where you're so fed up with the story you just want to let it go.
I've had that experience. Like my first story I wrote, the first story I sold, rather, I think I edited it probably 15 times, and then found out I had to sit on it for a while before I could turn it in. So, I'm extremely picky, but I'm also extremely egotistical, so I go back and read my own work a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly changing things, and what I originally, if I'm not careful, what I originally submitted to somebody will be a totally different thing by the time they
But it's just another pair of eyes on the work sometimes. Even for very tiny issues, you might not have noticed, because you get so close to a story that you're blindsided by it, you're blinkered, maybe you might not see the tiny issues or possibly a big issue that you haven't seen because you're in so deep with it.
Yeah.
I'm a raw beginner at this when it comes to the business of this, but I had never heard of a beta reader. I had never heard of a critique partner. I thought it was common for indie authors to do all of their own editing and things like that. I was dead wrong about that. Not all of them. Some of them do and are damn good at it. Damn it. Sorry. I lost my train again. It'll come back.
But I must admit, saying from what you were saying there, Shane, I do have a bit of a trust issue. If I'm going to allow someone to, well, say allow, see there I go. If I'm going to give my story to someone for their opinion, it's not because I mind them being critical. I just have to know that that person is sort of singing from the same hymn sheet and it's looking for the same sort of thing as what I want them to be looking for.
Yes, I'm the same, because I tend to have the same critique partners and the same beta readers all the time. But occasionally, for some reason, maybe somebody can't do it or somebody else says they'd like to read it. And sometimes we're just wrong for each other.
Yeah.
So. Like what they say doesn't gel with how I think, and it's not that I'm ignoring what they're saying, it's just that they don't get what I'm trying to put across.
And
that's what I didn't, what I was saying was about the critique partners and betas, is that I had never used one or anything. I started doing that when I started writing the poetry for Josh Mallerman. Laurel critiqued all of that for me, and I had other people, beta readers, go through it and, give me their opinions on it. And by the time I finished filtering it through all those different sources, it made me realize that I had a lot of learning to do. And it has, in the process, made me a much better poet than I was going into it.
We all thrive on feedback, even if it's very critical feedback.
And that was I thought I wouldn't be able to adapt to that, though, because I'm a very emotional person and I get my feelings hurt, and I was really, really worried that someone would just eviscerate me about something and I would just go, fuck, I quit. But I managed to get what I did to get around that is I submitted only to markets that I knew would reject me for the first several times that I submitted anything. Just to get myself used to seeing that. And it doesn't even faze me. Fazes me is whether I make a deadline or not. And if they reject it, that's fine. I just move on to the next one.
We've all got rhino skin when it comes to rejections, haven't we?
Definitely. It gets easier the more rejections you have.
The worst thing is thinking that you might have a chance. Like maybe you've seen a load of writers saying, "Oh, I've had my rejection letter from this press or this person," and you haven't, and you're like, "Oh, maybe I have a chance." And then 2 weeks later, it's like, "Wham! Here's your rejection letter."
The toughest ones, like you say, almost if you just have form rejection, without any feedback, I forget even to tell Tony that I've had a rejection, it's so insignificant. But when someone has told you, like I had one story, a short story, and they came back to me and said, she said, this was my personal favourite out of all of them, and I fought hammer and nail to get this one accepted. But she said, I was outvoted right at the end, and that was harder.
Oh, that is hard work.
The hardest one I did was having someone say, if you haven't heard from me yet, you're shortlisted. And then hear from them 3 days later that I was no longer shortlisted.
that's right, though. The further along the line you get,
but even that, I have to force myself to shrug that stuff off or I'll dwell on it. It gets in my way.
Yeah.
It's not that your story isn't good enough. It's that it's not right for the particular anthology that it's going into. Maybe it doesn't gel with the theme as well as the editor wants it to, or it doesn't gel with the other stories as well as the others. But one thing, you just dust it off and you know resubmit it somewhere else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's such a subjective business at the end of the day, isn't it?
Absolutely,
yes. It's never going to change. Any creative, you know, or any artistic business is the same.
And never mind. Lost my train of thought there. I don't think I even had one. I'm a horrible silence filler, and unfortunately I usually fill it with more silence. That's that topic for me.
do you have a favourite short story that you've written, Cam?
Yeah, Kublai.
That's the one I loved from Miss and Megalis. I love that story. It just got me right in the heart.
Yeah, it's so weird. I was saying to Tony just yesterday, it's almost like that story wrote itself. I can't even remember, you know, exactly where it started from, but I just sat down and it just wrote itself. It was, I do know where it came from. It was the first line, you know, the old man in the Fair Isle sweater sits at the mountain. And that line just came to me and it just went from there. But it really, I mean, there are personal connections there, so it is my favourite.
I know. My dad had a stroke and he was in a nursing home for a long time, and all the detailing that you put in there, it sort of brought a lump to my throat because I could just imagine that situation. It's a superb story, Carl. One of my very favourites, as I think I said in the review.
Thank you, Beth. It's so interesting hearing other people's favourites, though, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the first story in the book. I've actually read that one.
Kublai is the one before last.
Oh, is it?
You were thinking of Kragen. Krag is one about the shells, yeah.
And which is a damn good story. I misunderstood what you said.
No, it's fine. Kragen is the one that I had the flash version published with Flame Tree.
Oh, cool. That's right. You even mentioned it in your notes that there was a flash version of that. That's cool, too. If you're like me and you really, really dig story notes, every story in this book has story notes.
I didn't do them in my previous collection.
But you didn't do them in Door, did you?
Oh, no. And it was Scott Moses' collection, Hunger Pangs, and he had written story notes. And I read his collection. I thought, oh, I really like those story notes. I'm definitely a nosy person, so I love a bit of insight. And then, Scott Moses was the reason why I did story notes in Miss Megalis.
It just really works. It kind of brings you closer to the author in a way, doesn't it? To hear the process of the thoughts behind what inspired the stories.
And I mean, the most autobiographical one is Mara with the Spirit Box, because all of that was totally true. I didn't make any of
That is super scary, Kat. Very scary.
I mean, we own that box. We've recently got rid of it because we didn't want to bring that sort of bad feeling into this house. But even though all the issues with Tony's eyes that I write about in there, flood, the wall falling down when someone's car came into the wall, the three dead crows that morning, all of it, 100% true. It was uncanny.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm almost afraid to read it now.
you're almost afraid to read it because you'll know actually it's not fiction.
Exactly. And yet, as soon as we're done with this call, I'll probably read through that real quick. That way. Speaking of which, it's like 20 to 11 on your side of the water, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
Okay. We should probably wrap up.
Even though we could probably talk until midnight or gone, but I don't know how copacementy we would be, Kath, after another hour or so.
I felt so sorry for T.C. Parker and Steph.
Steph, Alice. Wasn't it, when you took them to 2 a.m. in the morning?
2 a.m. their time.
Absolutely couldn't do it. I'm such a morning person. I'm not a night owl at all. I would literally have to sit here like this.
And then especially poor Steph, because she, after we had planned another conversation after that, and that went so long. I think she was probably seeing daylight by the time she went to bed.
Oh. Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, I'll sit here explaining how late I kept those people until I keep you just as late. So anything you want to put out there before I close this off? Any news you want to share?
I would just say that for anybody listening, that they have to rush out and buy Immortal as soon as it's released, because Kath is just a force to be reckoned with. And I can say that because I've read both of her collections, and I know Immortality is going to be just as good, if not better.
Oh, that's really, really kind of you. And I loved your work too, you know that. And I'm really looking forward to the next one, definitely.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm also really thrilled that the three of us will be in Weird Tales together.
I know, at that.
That's fabulous.
I'm over the moon about that. That makes me so happy. It was surprised me that the one that I wrote actually got in.
I love that one, though, the pig one.
Yeah.
Pig. That was one of the ones I read for Sadie, I think. But, I concur wholeheartedly with Bev. I'm probably 3/4 of the way through Immortelle. It's brilliant. I'm loving every minute of it. I think it was Bev who actually introduced me to your short work, too.
Yeah.
It was me.
I owe you, Bev.
that comes out the 15th of next month.
Yeah.
Beverly Lee has The House of Little Bones coming out in September, hopefully, and I can attest to that book being just as brilliant as her other work. It's quiet, it's creepy, and it has scenes in it that make you put it down and walk away for a few minutes, because you scare the hell out of you. And I commented to Bev right after one scene I wrote that I just rarely get scared. I guess I'm done. What about you, Catherine? Did you have anything to follow up with before we...
No, I'd just like to thank you so much once again for your time and also your friendship, both of you, because it was so nice coming on you today, because I felt like I already knew you both in real life.
Oh, yeah, I feel the same way, Kath. It's been very nice to actually speak to you as opposed to just writing words.
Yeah. Absolutely. We're always finding out how similar we are, Bev, aren't we?
All the time. All the time.
You're two of my favorite people in the world, on social media and, glad to know you, and I will have you back again and again and again if you want to come back.
Okay, thank you very much, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. You guys have a good night.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dan. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I will never die.